Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a place with, well, a lot of names. Nebihori, Cirrus, Hagiopolis, Khor-Rosh.
Yeah, that list alone tells you something, doesn't it? It screams history, layers of it.
Exactly, it's like a linguistic map of its past. And you, our listener, sent over your sources on this really fascinating spot. So our mission today is to unpack that story.
From ancient Cirrus, way back when.
Right up to Nebihori today. We want to give you the essential understanding, a shortcut through its really complex history.
And it's fascinating how those names really do track the dominant cultures, you know? Cirrus, clearly Hellenistic,
Hagiopolis.
Byzantine Christian, absolutely. Then Khor-Rosh signals the Islamic period.
And Nebihori, the local tradition that sticks today. It's like peeling back layers.
Precisely. Each name is a chapter.
So, geographically, where exactly are we?
We're in Syria, modern-day Syria, the Afrin region, which is part of the Aleppo governorate.
Okay, near the Turkish border then.
Very close, yeah. Just a few kilometers. Near a town called Bulbul. And maybe 70 kilometers or so northwest of Aleppo itself.
So strategically positioned.
Hugely strategic. It's right near the Afrin River, locally called the Sebun River.
Historically, the Marseillaise, right?
That's the one, a tributary of the Orontes. And that river valley was a natural corridor.
Okay.
But the crucial thing, Cirrus was smack bang on the main road connecting Antioch, the big Mediterranean port.
With Zeugma, the crossing point on the Euphrates.
Exactly. So it was this vital link. East-west traffic, trade, armies, everything flowed through or near there for centuries.
Right, so definitely not some isolated spot. It was central.
Absolutely central, which explains its role in trade, military stuff, and, well, unfortunately, modern conflict, too.
Okay, let's get into that current name then, Nebihori. What does that actually mean?
Nebihori is Arabic for Prophet Hori.
Prophet Hori and the local story.
The main local tradition says there was this holy man, Hori, who lived nearby, maybe near an old monastery. And because he was so pious, the place, especially that big tomb there, got named after him.
Seems straightforward enough. But the sources also mention something else, a much older idea connecting Hori to the Hurrians.
Yes, that's a really intriguing theory. It suggests the name might be a kind of linguistic fossil.
A fossil. How so?
Well, the Hurrians were a major group in the Near East way back in the 3rd and 2nd millennia BCE, non-Semitic people.
Right.
So the idea is that Hori could be an echo, a survival of their name in the region.
Is there any evidence for that besides the name itself?
There's some circumstantial stuff, like other places nearby in Afrin also have Hurri in their names. Caves, ruins, sometimes described locally as maybe Hurrian. And even Mount Hawar nearby sounds a bit similar phonetically. It's speculative, of course, but it's tempting to think Nebihori holds this like incredibly deep memory.
A memory stretching back thousands of years. But the main local belief today isn't about the Hurrians, is it? It's about Uri the Hittite.
That's the dominant one, yes. The most common identification locally is with Uriah the Hittite, you know, King David's commander from the Bible.
Right, from the story with David and Bathsheba.
Exactly. Some Arabic sources call him Uriah, son of Hanan. And the local narrative is that he was killed in battle nearby and buried right there.
Okay.
There's even speculation linking it to a time, maybe around 1000 BCE, when David's influence might have briefly reached the Aleppo area.
Interesting. And this belief is strong locally.
Very strong, including among local Kurdish families who've had a long connection to the shrine.
And then we look at the actual building, that hexagonal tomb. Archaeology tells a different story, doesn't it?
It does. When archaeologists examine the structure itself, that hexagonal tower tomb, it's Roman.
Roman.
Definitely Roman, dated probably to the 2nd or 3rd century CE. The style, the architecture, it points strongly to being the tomb of a Roman military official.
Someone important, given Cirrus was a legionary base.
Exactly, high-ranking figure, but then much later it gets repurposed.
Okay, when was that?
We know for sure that in 1303 CE, during the Mamluk period, it was officially converted into a Muslim shrine, a maqam.
Dedicated to Nebihori.
Dedicated specifically to Nebihori. They identified the lower level as his grave, and then a mosque was built right next to it in 1314.
Right. So Uriah the Hittite, roughly 1000 BCE. The tomb, 2nd or 3rd century CE. That's a massive gap.
A huge gap, over a millennium.
How does that happen? How does a Roman tomb get linked to a biblical figure from so much earlier?
It's actually a pretty common thing at sacred sites all over the world. You have a prominent ancient monument, and later generations or different cultures kind of project their own important figures and stories onto it. The association with Uriah is clearly a later attribution.
So the Roman soldier or whoever it was forgotten, and Uriah's story took over.
Essentially, yes. Or rather, a new layer of meaning was added. It doesn't mean Uriah couldn't have been in the region, though.
Right, because the Hittites were around then.
Exactly. The Hittites were a major power in Anatolia and Syria. So a Hittite commander like Uriah being in that area around 1000 BCE, entirely plausible historically.
Was not buried in that specific Roman tomb.
Precisely. The veneration of Nebiori is this amazing example of layering. Roman tomb, maybe some Christian associations later, then formally brought into the Islamic tradition by the Mamluks, probably incorporating existing local beliefs, whether about Hori, Uriah, or maybe even those faint Hurrian echoes.
Fascinating. Okay, we've untangled the names and the figures. Let's trace the city's history now, starting right at the beginning, Hellenistic Cyrus.
Right. Founded by Seleucus Inicator, one of Alexander the Great's successors.
When exactly?
Shortly after 300 BCE. And he deliberately named it Cyrus, after a city back in Macedonia, his home.
Okay. And it was a planned city.
Very much so. Laid out on a grid, the Hippodamian plan. Mm-hmm. Straight streets, right angles, classic Hellenistic urban design.
With walls and stuff.
Yeah, early fortifications were built with polygonal masonry, those big irregular blocks. And under the Seleucids, it was a key military base.
You mentioned coins earlier.
That's right. It even had the right to mint its own coins, which tells you it was pretty important.
Any signs of temples?
Archaeology suggests maybe temples to Greek gods. Athena Polias, perhaps? And Zeus Kyranios, possibly up on the Acropolis, the high point.
So a proper Greek city in Syria.
Pretty much. It became more of a frontier city after a treaty in 188 BCE. And then, briefly, the Grannies the Great of Armenia took control around 83 BCE, just before the Romans showed up.
Ah, the Romans. 64 BCE, they annex it. And that seems to be when Cyrus really took off.
It really had. Under Rome, it boomed. Became a major administrative center, military hub, and crucial commercial point on that Antioch-Sigma road.
The legion was based there.
Legio ex Fratensis, yes. Yep. The 10th legion. That alone shows its military significance.
And they built a lot.
Oh, yeah. Classic Roman infrastructure. The huge theater, 115 meters across, still quite well preserved.
Wow.
At least two Roman bridges, which remarkably still stand. The hexagonal mausoleum we keep talking about. A main street lined with columns, an aqueduct, public baths.
The works, basically.
Pretty much. We even have remains of houses, like one found with mosaics and wall paintings. It continued minting coins, too, provincial ones.
So, a wealthy, important Roman city.
Definitely. And because it was on that route east, Roman commanders, even emperors sometimes, would pass through on their way to campaigns.
But being on the frontier also meant trouble.
Yes, exactly. It got attacked and even sacked by the Sasanian Persians a few times in the 3rd century CE.
Ouch.
Which ironically led the Romans to invest even more in strengthening its defenses later on.
Right. And wasn't some famous Roman born there?
Avidius Cassius, yes. The guy who briefly tried to become emperor in 175 CE. A little slice of Roman imperial drama connected right to Cyrus.
Huh. Okay, so Rome really established it as this crucial node.
Absolutely. That role as a connector, linking the Mediterranean world with the East via the Euphrates, was cemented under Rome. And that importance, that fundamental geography, just kept playing out.
Okay, fast forward. The Roman Empire splits. Cyrus becomes part of the Eastern or Byzantine Empire, and its identity shifts again, right, to Hagiopolis.
Yes, Hagiopolis, City of the Saints. This is when it really becomes a major Christian center.
How did that happen?
It became the capital of its province, Cyrestica, and an important bishopric. So administratively and religiously significant within the Byzantine system.
But City of the Saints, why that name specifically?
Because of the relics of Saints Cosmas and Damian.
Ah, the physician saints.
Exactly. Twin brothers, doctors, martyred nearby around 283 CE. Their relics were brought to Cyrus and enshrined in a major basilica there.
And that made it a big deal.
A huge deal. It turned Hagiopolis into a massive pilgrimage site. People came from all over the Byzantine East seeking healing, miracles.
So religion becomes central to the city's identity and economy.
Totally. And its bishops were important figures attending major church councils. Tells you something about its theological standing.
You mentioned a specific bishop, Theodoret.
Yes, Bishop Theodoret, around 423 CE. Very influential writer. He really promoted the cult of Cosmas and Damian.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, he used church money to fix up the city's infrastructure. The aqueduct, the bridges, shows how closely church and state, or church and city life, were intertwined.
So the city was thriving as a religious center. Did they keep up the defenses?
Yes. Emperor Justinian III, in the 6th century, reinforced the fortifications. He specifically strengthened the southern wall, which actually enclosed the area where the Nebihori Mausoleum stands. So even then, that spot was seen as strategically important.
Right. Okay, so thriving Byzantine pilgrimage city. But then another major shift. The Arab conquest in 637 CE.
A huge turning point. Arab armies conquered Cyrus, and the name changed again to Koresh or Koros.
And its role? Did it stay important?
Initially, probably served as a military base for the new rulers. But overall, its importance started to fade.
Declined. How so?
Well, there's this theory, maybe more than a theory, that stones from that famous Basilica of Saints Cosmas and Damian.
The pilgrimage church.
Yeah, were actually taken to Aleppo and reused in the Great Umayyad Mosque there.
Wow. That suggests a real shift in priorities.
Absolutely. And over the following centuries, the city itself seems to have shrunk. By the 13th century, a geographer, Yaqut al-Hamawi, basically called it a dead city.
A dead city. So largely abandoned.
Seems like in terms of urban life.
Mm-hmm.
But the site itself wasn't entirely forgotten, especially its sacred aspect.
Ah, because of the Mamluk revival.
Exactly. During the Mamluk era, even though the city was mostly ruins, that Roman mausoleum gets its new lease on life. 1303 CE, it's formally converted into the Nebihori Shrine.
And the mosque built next door?
In 1314. So it becomes a local center for Muslim worship and pilgrimage. Not empire-wide like Hagiopolis, but important for the surrounding region.
And this continued under the Ottomans?
Yes. The religious complex kept functioning. The Mamluk mosque was eventually replaced by a new Ottoman one in 1875, maybe rebuilt earlier too. Shows it remained a living religious site for the local community.
Before we move on from the historical timeline, there was that brief Crusader period too, right?
Ah, yes. A short but interesting chapter. Around 1117 to 1150 CE.
So about 30 years or so.
Roughly. Cyrus fell under Frankish control, part of the county of Edessa, one of the Crusader states.
And they called it Corsi?
Corsi, yeah. It seems to have had some importance for them. Maybe even the seat of a Latin archbishop.
Really? So strategically valuable to the Crusaders too?
It seems so. We know there were lords of Cyrus who were vassals of the counts of Edessa.
But it didn't last long.
No. Nur ad-Din, the Zengid ruler, captured it in 1150, and reports say it was pretty badly damaged during that conquest.
Which probably didn't help its long-term prospects as a city.
Likely contributed further to its decline.
Yeah, okay. It's just amazing how the religious focus of this one spot keeps shifting. Let's dig into that sacred landscape a bit more.
Sure. So, going way back, Hellenistic period, we assume Greek pagan worship, those potential temples to Athena and Zeus point to that.
And maybe even earlier, those Hurrian echoes we talked about.
Possibly, yeah. Very speculative, but the name link is there. But the absolute peak of its religious fame was the Byzantine era, Hagiopolis.
With Cosmas and Damian.
Absolutely. The basilica, the relics, the stream of pilgrims from all over the empire seeking cures. That was its heyday as a sacred center. Mm-hmm. Bishops like Theodoret really pushed his profile.
Then the shift after the conquest.
Right. Christian importance fades, maybe the relics even moved. And then centuries later, the focus shifts to that Roman tomb, reborn as the Nebihori, or Uriah Shrine, under the Mamluks.
Becoming important for local Muslims.
Hugely important locally. People from nearby villages came to pray, especially on Fridays and holidays. There were even local beliefs about it having wish-granting powers.
So it maintained a powerful sacred aura just for a different community and centered on a different figure.
Exactly. And you see that transition in communities too, Byzantine Christians across the empire. Then later, local Muslims in the Afrin area, including those Kurdish families who were caretakers for generations.
A real continuity of the space being sacred, even as the specifics changed?
Precisely. The location itself held on to its sacredness. And interestingly, the scale changed too. From empire-wide fame as Hagiopolis to a more localized but still deeply felt significance as Nebihori.
Let's turn to the ground now, the archaeology. What can we actually see there, or what have excavations revealed about the city's layout?
Well, you can still trace the basic plan. The lower town clearly had that organized Hellenistic grid. And then there's the Acropolis, the higher ground, probably where the main temple, maybe Zeus's, stood.
And the walls?
You see the evolution, those early Hellenistic polygonal walls, then later, more substantial Roman and Byzantine defenses. Justinian's reinforcements in the 6th century are quite evident, especially around the south gate.
Have they excavated the gates?
Yes. The Southgate excavations were really useful. They found multiple phases of construction, showing how the defenses were adapted and rebuilt over time.
Okay. And specific buildings, what are the highlights that remain?
Well, top of the list has to be the hexagonal mausoleum, the Nibihori tomb itself. It's very distinctive, quite well preserved considering.
And the theater.
The Roman theater is impressive. Still very large. You get a real sense of its scale. Then the two Roman bridges, still standing, which is amazing.
Wow.
You can trace the line of the main colonnaded street, the Cardo. And near the north gate, there are remains of two basilicas.
Could one of those be the basilica, Cosmas and Damian's?
It's possible, yeah. Though we talked about the stones maybe being reused in Aleppo. Hard to say for sure without more evidence.
Anything else?
Yeah. Bits of the city gates, parts of the aqueduct system, foundations of bathhouses. There are also signs of what might have been the Roman military camp south of the main city. Oh, and a tetrapylon, a four-way arch structure, also south of the main site.
It sounds like a massive site, archaeologically speaking. Who's done the main work there?
A lot of the early foundational work was done by French missions, sort of mid to late 20th century.
Okay.
More recently, there's been a joint Lebanese-Syrian mission working there, too.
Any really standout discoveries?
That Roman house they found was pretty special, with mosaics and wall paintings still partly intact. Gave a real glimpse into daily life.
But you said it was looted.
Sadly, yes. Back in 2008. Some mosaic panels were damaged or stolen, though some were rescued and taken to Aleppo.
That's awful. What about other techniques?
They've used geophysical surveys, you know, scanning beneath the ground, which helps map out structures you can't see on the surface.
And inscriptions. They always tell a story.
Loads of inscriptions, yeah. Byzantine ones mentioning building work. A Roman tombstone for a soldier of Legio X Fratensis, confirming their presence. Various Christian inscriptions, too.
It really does paint a picture of this layered city.
Absolutely. You see the Hellenistic plan, the Roman engineering, the Byzantine churches, all physically there, one on top of the other. It's a textbook example of cultural layering.
And the fact the mausoleum stayed sacred probably saved it, didn't it?
Almost certainly. Its continuous religious use, even as the dedication changed, likely protected it from being completely dismantled or quarried for stone like so many other ancient structures.
Which brings us, unfortunately, to the modern era and the conflict in Syria. This has been devastating for heritage sites. How has Nibihori fared?
Terribly, I'm afraid. Before the war, it was a protected site. People visited tourists, pilgrims, research was happening.
But then?
Then came Operation Olive Branch in 2018. Turkish-backed forces took control of the area. And soon after, credible reports started coming out about serious damage.
What kind of damage?
Allegations of the site being used militarily. And worse, widespread, systematic looting. We're talking heavy machinery digging into the archaeological layers.
Oh, no. Not just pot hunting, but industrial-scale destruction.
That's what the reports indicate.
Yeah.
Huge mounds of excavated earth visible in satellite imagery. Irreparable damage to the site's stratigraphy, its historical record.
Heartbreaking. What about the main tomb, the Nibihori shrine itself? Was that targeted?
Yes, tragically. Reports from eyewitnesses and monitoring groups describe damage and looting at the mausoleum by fighters from these groups.
Doing what?
Trying to dig under the sarcophagus, apparently. Looking for treasure, presumably. There were also specific reports of mosaics being looted from inside the structure.
Unbelievable. And other parts of the city?
Damage reported on the citadel area, too. And some suggested this looting was happening quite openly, with access for independent monitors basically cut off.
Just devastating. Utterly devastating. The loss of that connection.
It's horrific. These aren't just stones and dirt. They're layers of human history being erased.
But then Turkey launched a restoration project.
That's right. Starting around 2019, Turkish authorities, specifically the Hati Vakıflar Directorate, began restoration work, focused mainly on the Nibihori tomb and the mosque next to it.
What did they do?
Consolidation of the structures, fixing them up, improving facilities, providing utilities like water and electricity. And they're now promoting it as the Mosque of the Prophet Hiri.
But this restoration hasn't been without controversy, has it?
Not at all. It's been highly controversial. There are serious accusations that the restoration process itself caused further damage. Allegations that older archaeological material, original architectural features, were removed or destroyed during the work.
Oh, dear.
And beyond that, there's criticism about the narrative being pushed. Accusations of, well, Ottomanization or Turkification.
Meaning
the restoration emphasizes the Ottoman era aspects and the connection to Prophet Hiri, while potentially downplaying or obscuring the site's much longer Roman, Byzantine, and even local Syrian or Kurdish heritage.
So using restoration to promote a particular historical narrative.
That's the accusation. Oh. And it's impossible to ignore the context here. This restoration happened after extensive looting occurred under the watch of forces backed by the same authority now doing the restoring.
Yeah, that context is crucial. It makes the whole thing very complex.
Well, deeply complex. The act of restoration itself becomes political, especially in a conflict zone. Whose history gets preserved, whose gets highlighted, whose gets erased.
So what's the situation right now? Is the site accessible? Is research possible?
Currently, no. It remains under the control of Turkish-backed forces. Access for independent researchers, archaeologists, heritage monitors is severely restricted, if not impossible.
And the site's integrity.
Profoundly compromised. The looting did immense damage. While the central two mosque complex has been restored, that's just one small part of this vast ancient city that suffered damage.
It's just a stark example of heritage caught in conflict.
Absolutely. Vulnerable to damage, looting, military use, and then becoming a tool in political and cultural struggles through things like restoration and narrative control.
This deep dive has really covered a huge span of time. Nibi Hori, Cyrus, seeing it go from that Hellenistic city, key Roman hub,
to Byzantine pilgrimage city of the saints.
Then the local Nibi Hori shrine, important for centuries, all on that same strategic spot.
Its location was its destiny, in a way.
Mm.
And its sacredness endured, even as the labels changed.
But the recent history, the conflicts, the looting, the contested restoration, it's just tragic for such a multi-layered place.
It truly is. And it leaves us and you, our listener, with some really tough questions, doesn't it?
Like what?
Well, given everything that's happened, the damage, the looting, the controversial nature of the restoration, what is the future for a site like Nibi Hori, especially in conflict zones?
And what's the responsibility of the wider world, the international community? How do we even begin to safeguard places like this with such complex histories and vulnerabilities?
Exactly. It forces you to think about how historical stories are told, who gets to tell them, the political agendas at play, and our basic duty, really, to try and protect this shared human past for whatever future comes next.